Because that's why I'm going, Marta. I want to see who the influencers are.
You are an influencer.
I thought you were an influencer for sure.
Listen, I'm going into the room to see who's in there. And I'm going to go tell them about this after school program that I'm getting ready to launch for the summer. Definitely going to be texting you, Marta. Every time I see a new face, I'm texting you who walked in the room. So
I got that press release. I sent it to Katie right away. And I was like, who the f*** are the influencers?
This is Behind the Lens, a podcast from The Lens, New Orleans' first nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest newsroom. I'm Carolyn Heldman. On this week's episode, the Orleans Parish School Board reversed course on a beloved local school and will now operate it as a direct-run institution after announcing to the community that it would be shut down. And New Orleans lost another treasured musician on Mardi Gras morning when Kerry Fat Man Hunter was killed after he was struck by a car. Those stories, insight, and analysis coming up on Behind the Lens. Joining us this week, education reporter and deputy editor Marta Jusen. Hi, Marta.
Hey, Carolyn.
Special guest, Dr. Ashanta Wyatt, former principal of the Edgar P. Harney Spirit of Excellence Academy. Welcome, Dr. Wyatt.
Well, thank you for having me.
Photojournalist LaShance Perry's here. Hey, LaShance.
Hi, Carolyn.
And Lens editor, Katie Rechtdahl. Hey, Katie.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thanks. All right, Marta, let's start with the Lafayette Academy. We talked about them before. Remind us of the herky-jerky. Remind us of all the craziness that's been going on with this school.
Yeah, so the district has really thrown this school and the families and staff for a loop this fall, to say the least. I think what's one important thing to point out is that in the fall, when they kind of forecast what schools might not be renewed or kept open last year, Lafayette wasn't even on the list. It wasn't like in the realm of schools that they were worried might not make the grade when state letter grades came out in the fall. And then all of a sudden in November, when they did not make the grade that they thought they were going to make, here comes Lafayette, and it turns out that they're going to have to close down and they won't be renewed for their final and fifth year of their charter contract. So Lafayette's administration, the Community Academies of New Orleans, they tried to fight it. They realized they weren't going to win, and then they said, okay, we will, you know, agree to hand over our charter, with the understanding that the school was going to stay open under a new charter operator. No one applied to run the school. The district then kind of sat on that for a while. And then about a month after that deadline had passed and no one applied to run the school, the district said they were going to close it. Then a week later, they came back and said, actually, they were going to run it themselves. So just, sorry for the long intro. It really has been quite a trial for families to be put through this. So now, the most recent move is that, you know, the board considered an item to open a new school at that site.
Dr. Wyatt, you've been an advocate, longtime advocate for kids in the system and schools and education in New Orleans. Can you talk to us about what it means that Lafayette is going to be operated as a direct-run institution now?
Sure. As I said prior to this conversation, the entire premise of the charter movement is to afford parents an opportunity to have a choice in where they send their children to school. Well, with having the option for a district-run school, all it does is widen the idea of choice. So in my mind, you know, if we're going to say we are affording parents choice, then authentic choice is to have more than one singular choice to choose from. Mm. And prior to the vote to make Lafayette direct run, our only choice was a charter school. And some charters are doing absolutely well. They're doing what schools are supposed to do, and some of them are not. And my push to the district is when those charters fail to meet the mark, instead of renewing them for another 5 years, the district should take the reins and direct run them and give those schools all of the resources needed to level up academically for those students. So I think this option to directly run a school is in the best interest of not just the children at Lafayette, but the community at large.
Dr. Y, you made a really interesting point when we were talking at the school board meeting the other night about what direct run also meant for the superintendent to, because right now she's basically the manager of a bunch of contracts to run schools. And so can you talk a little bit about what this means as far on the academic side and for the district to be involved?
Absolutely. It will give our superintendent an opportunity to be the chief academic officer of a school. And so what that does for us is Lafayette has all of the resources it needs inside of our schoolhouse or our district. And to have the superintendent who is a qualified educator, who is licensed to be a superintendent, it will give us the opportunity to have someone who is well versed in education, well resourced with all of the chiefs she has at her disposal to actually put a curriculum in place, put a plan in place to not only meet the needs of those children in that building, but to show us what traditional education could look like post 100% charter network here in our community. So I'm excited. I think everybody's excited to see the trajectory of where we can go. And the idea that she's going to slow grow Lafayette is promising as well. And in that 5-year plan, she's also hoping to run more schools directly. So I support her. I believe that she can make this work. But I also believe that we have to have buy-in from the entire community that surrounds that school to make certain that we all have a hand in its success.
Dr. Wyatt, when you say she, you're referring to Dr. Williams, Superintendent Avis Williams, who has never been here previously, under her tenure, under her leadership, which is only 2 years now, I think, they have never direct run any schools. So you're placing a lot of faith in her from her previous mm-hmm. experience?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm placing a lot of faith in her because the school board hired her. Mm-hmm. So I'm not the only person that has faith in her. Our entire school board unanimously voted her in the seat. And so my faith lies in this idea that everybody who are duly elected to serve their district says that she's qualified, said that she's capable. I had an opportunity to look over her resume on paper. It says that she's competent. It says that she's able. And I've heard her speak a number of times when she was chasing this job. And so the things she was saying spoke to me as an educator, spoke to me as a school leader. I just think she didn't have the space to actually show us what that looks like in practice because we were 100% charter. So she didn't have any schools to directly impact. All she was doing was authorizing or revoking charters and just managing a portfolio of schools. Well, now she gets to directly run one. She gets to show us what she can do academically for our children. And I'm excited to see where she goes with this. But my faith is not solely in her. My faith is in our elected officials who also unanimously voted her in the seat. So not only am I supporting her, but I have an optimistic view of the elected officials who say she's more than capable to lead us in this effort to directly run schools.
A little bit of a left field question. As a parent, I was taught that you parent the child, the individual child. You don't have this blanket parenting style. You try to parent to where the kid is. Is it similar to do that with schools? And if so, would the curriculum for Lafayette look different than another school that she might craft a curriculum for?
So I do support the premise of, you know, you give individual children what they need to individually thrive as a parent. And I think that premise can also apply to schools. It's applicable, right? But when you think about a curriculum, there should be a state mandated curriculum for schools to follow as a guide, right? But as a school leader, you know, you can tweak that curriculum to meet the needs of your children, just as a teacher can tweak that curriculum to meet the needs of their individual classrooms. So there should still be a guiding force academic-wise that leads her. And then from there, she should be able to curtail that to meet the needs of Lafayette. And then when the teachers get said curriculum, they're going to make it such that it meets the individual needs of their classrooms. So as long as there's a guide, a curriculum guide, we all had it. We had pacing guides in school. There exists a pacing guide that tells you what you should be learning at this point. How you make that look is where the individualism comes from.
Okay.
But there still should be a pacing guide that says in October, we should be learning about this in history. We should be learning about this in ELA. So there's a pacing guide But of course, she should be able to have the autonomy to craft that to meet the needs of the Lafayette students, just as those teachers who are going to be tasked with teaching in that building should have the autonomy to adapt it to the classrooms that they service.
I think, too, she, and like Dr. Wyatt said, she said that she plans to take on a tier one curriculum for the school. Mm-hmm. And I think the curriculum part will probably be one of the easier parts of crafting the school, because now what you've got to do is, over the course of a summer, is find your teaching staff and the rest of your academic staff. And particularly for those teachers at Lafayette right now, I think a question for them is, do they want to stay with their current employer, Community Academy of New Orleans, and move to one of those other charters, or do they want to stay with their kids or some of their kids who might be returning? So it is, you know, in ways it is going to be a new school. And part of creating that model is going to be figuring out these staffing things. So they do have a lot of things to do to get there. But like Dr. White said, it's not completely reinventing the wheel by any means.
And another part to think about, Marta, is since it's going to be direct run, traditionally, direct-run schools come unionized. So will the teachers have an opportunity to buy into the union? That's mm-hmm. a question. Mm-hmm. Because when they're chartered, it's a different landscape. But if you're going to direct-run, meaning from district to the building, that should come with an option to unionize. So that's another something that's important, because that will help make the teachers decide if they want to stay or not. Because if I have the option to unionize, I think I might want to stay here where I can get due process in an at-will state.
Dr. White, do you feel like this school actually, when Marta was running the data on it, the school had such a high number of people, kids who lived within 1 mile of the school, right? And I know in recent years, you've seen the elementary school zone develop with preference in the zone. What about neighborhood schools in the city? Like, do you think that we're missing an opportunity to, or do you think this is an example of one? How do you think that this could set the pace for that, given its data currently?
I think it's promising to have an option to go to school across the street from your home. And when we think about choice, as a parent, I should have that choice. If I want to put my child in the one app and decide to go elsewhere, that should be my choice. But if there's a school across the street from my home, that should be first preference, not only for families, but from the standpoint of the school board. Typically, they have like percentages of how they open up the seats. But if you're going to say that, you know, I believe in neighborhood schools, I think... And, you know, I'm an advocate for neighborhood schools, but I am also an advocate to say that if your neighborhood school does not meet the needs of your child, then you should have the option to go elsewhere. But we as a community don't have an option to say, simply because I'm across the street from a school, that gives me choice to go to that school. It's chance. I put my name in the one app, and one app tells me where I'm going to go. And I don't think it gives enough of a preference, so to speak, or enough of consideration for people who are across the street or a block away or around the corner from a school. So if we're going to authentically talk about a system that relegates itself to choice, then I should be able to have the choice to go to school across the street from my home if that is my choice for my child. And right now we don't see that. So hopefully with this school being direct run, it opens up this idea of trying to see the mechanics of what a neighborhood school can function like, what it would look like, and how it would impact families. So I think we're moving in a direction of that. And I think this can be a pilot for what neighborhood school, well-resourced neighborhood schools could look like for our children.
I also have a question for you as well, Dr. Wyatt. So my question is, a lot of one of the concerns that we often heard, not only from parents, but from some of the students and children themselves, is maintaining the culture that is already at the school. And specifically for Lafayette, what we continuously heard is that they have a family culture, that legacy is a huge, huge part of what makes the school what it is for the children and also the educators and the parents and so on and so forth. So I'm just curious to know, from your perspective as a parent and also your expertise as an educator, how important is maintaining culture when switching schools or implementing new systems?
I think it's vital. And I think, to be quite frank, that is why a lot of systems fail, because you want to come in and just demo everything as opposed to respecting what you find there that works. And if the parents in the community is saying to us that the culture is something that they covet, then we ought to respect that. So whoever goes into that space, when Dr. Williams decides to staff it and, you know, and direct run it, she ought to be having those conversations with those families and taking an inventory of what they say has to stay and what is working. And we just ensure that it continues to work. And then the things that are not working, we're going to put some things in place and resources such that it can get to the point where families are proud of that thing that isn't working. So I think it's vital to respect what you find. Just like culture is important to the entire city of New Orleans, culture is important to our schools as well. And so my issue with gentrification, right, is that most of it does not come in and respect what they find here. They just demo everything and try to give us what they want us to have. You know, you could always tell architecture in New Orleans that is naturally New Orleans, and then you can go and see things that don't belong. It's like it's out of place, right? And we don't want our families to feel out of place when they walk into Lafayette simply because it's direct run. Mm-hmm. So we have to respect the cultural things that are there that are working for the that are working for the families. And then we have to also go in and diagnose the things that are weak and need a little extra tender love and care to get it where we could also be proud of those things as well. So short answer is it's vital to respect what you find there and honor what the families say that they need in a school, and respect the home community school partnership. We have to. There's no way you could do school well by ignoring the community or ignoring what families are saying that they want for their children.
Dr. Wyatt, I heard you speak, I think, in front of the city council, and you were advocating for how important it is for educators to recognize and value each child where they are. I'm wondering if you think that how will this direct run system be able to accommodate that? Do you think she'll need to ensure that as much of the staff stays as possible? How can she make that happen? How do schools make that happen?
So to me, that goes back to the inventory, right? She has to take inventory of that community. And every child that is a current Lafayette student, she should have them in a room and she should be having conversations with them and their families. Whether that's through a survey, whether that's through question and answers, just authentically talking to them. But I think talking to the families is going to give her a lot of the answers to fill a lot of the angst or the gaps that we're thinking she's going to have. She has to have that communication with them. I'm not saying that every teacher that was at Lafayette deserves to stay at Lafayette. But what I'm saying is, if we don't talk to the families, if we don't talk to the children, we don't know who they want to stay there and whom they could do without, for lack of a better way to say that. But I think it's also about taking stock or inventory of the current staff that's there. People may weed themselves out simply by saying, this is not what I want to do. I prefer to work for a charter. I prefer, you know, to make $5,000-$6,000 more than you're offering me. I mean, there's a number of reasons why teachers are going to choose to stay or choose to go. It's going to be a number of reasons why families choose to stay or choose to go. But unless you take an inventory of that by talking directly to those who are directly impacted, we won't necessarily know. And I don't think she should go in making blind decisions without talking to those people first. And that's about respecting the culture, and that's about respecting the landscape that she's going to inherit. And then she can do with that information what she sees best as the superintendent. But I think she owes it to those families and to that community to have that conversation before any decisions are made.
I think final question, and this is to both of you, this is a sea change in how this is affecting our community and schools. There hasn't been direct run schools in New Orleans in a long, long time. Did you get any hint that this was indeed the word you used earlier, Dr. Wyatt, was pilot? Is this, do you think, a pilot program that they're going to test this out, and if this works, that they might consider doing this, or is this a one-off?
Well, Carolyn, I promise you, when you were asking me that question, in my mind, I was saying, if they had led with that premise in mind to say, let's pilot this charter school idea.
Yeah.
I think it would have been received better by the community. They didn't choose to do that. What they did was say, everything you're doing is wrong. We need to get rid of it all. And they started from ground zero, which is where I believe the great divide happened and the divisiveness happened. So at least with this idea of one school being directly run, and maybe we can think of it as a pilot, at least we're giving them the grace that they did not extend to us, because we're not trying to blow up your whole system. What we're trying to say is, if you say that this is about innovation and choice, what better way to introduce innovation and choice other than putting another option in play for families? And if it works, we get to replicate it per your guidelines, right? Because that's what charter law says. It says, if what you're doing is working, let's replicate it and do some more of it. If it does not work, guess what? It's a one-off, it's one school, it's one group of kids. It's not 18 years of children that we're blowing up, right?
Testing
we're just
on.
Doing this one thing. And so for me, I wish that when they decided to come back post-Katrina, they could have come back how we left it and say, let's pilot this idea of ours to see if it works. And let's do some data collection on it, because that's another issue that I have with the charter system is everybody gets to self-report. Nobody's actually monitoring the data to say if it's true or if it's not true. You're graduating 100% of the kids, but we don't know where the cohort of kids have gone from their freshman year to their senior year, right? So there are a lot of questions that we don't have answers to. But even with that being said, some schools are still thriving and doing school right for children. So I'm not saying the entire charter system is a bust. What I'm saying is, for the majority of our children, this system is not working. And we need to start to do things differently if we want to do right by our kids. And I think to direct run this school is a step in a direction of saying, here is choice, here is some innovation, because we've not had a direct run school in nearly 20 years. Let's see how it goes. And if it works well, we'll introduce another direct run. We'll go from there.
Tell me what works well to you. When do you look at that? When do you how do you evaluate what's working and when?
The easiest way for me to know when a school is servicing the needs of children is to look at the community it's in, and hear what the families are saying. Because if a family is going to board meetings and speaking up on behalf of the school leadership and the school, if the community and the community stakeholders and our elected officials are showing up to school board meetings and saying this school is what we need in this community, then something is going to make me say, well, what are they doing over there? I need to go and see what they're doing over there. So my whole thing is, I don't just say if a school is doing well by academia, because in the charter system, academics looks vastly different than how it looked when I was in school. So I don't measure it by that. I'm not a standardized test tells us the whole picture sort of educator. That's not who I am. But if teachers are year in and year out signing that document to come back, if families are year in and year out signing their children up to come, and the growth scores are aligning with what you're saying you're doing, and I can see and feel the energy from a school and the culture is what it's supposed to be. It's a formula for what makes a good school a good school. But when our children can't read, it's alarming. And when more than 70% of them can't read, it's a crisis. So I know just on that piece of data alone that there's an issue and we need to address it. And that's all I'm saying. Ben Franklin, I believe, is doing well because Ben Franklin has a formula and a system, and I don't care who the school leader is or who runs it, it's going to do well because it's a system that works. And I can say the same thing about the Lushers and you know, the Warren Eastons and the Cars of the world. They have developed a system that works for their demographic of children, and all kids deserve that. And so I think you can't measure the success of school by one measurement. You have to take into account all of the facets that make schools operate and operate well. And if you could check the box for all of those things, it's going to get my attention. And I'm going to say, well, what's going on over there that we need to take from there and bring it over here so that all of our kids benefit from that?
I appreciate your passion and your time. Thank you so much, Dr. Wyatt.
No, thank you for having me.
And I'm asking you, give me the sugar that you don't want. Don't send them to jail. fuck I was them. I used to fight with my sister until somebody sold my mail. The children fighting fuck with guns because y'all ain't let them know they matter. That's the problem.
This is Behind the Lens, a podcast from The Lens, New Orleans' first nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest newsroom. I'm Carolyn Heldman. Thanks to our guest this week, Deputy Editor and Education Reporter Marta Jusen. Special guest, Dr. Ashanta Wyatt, former principal of Edgar P. Harney Spirit of Excellence Academy, photojournalist LaShance Perry, and Lens editor, Katie Rechtall.
Hi, I'm Delaney Dreyfus, environmental reporter at The Lens. You rely on The Lens for thoughtful, questioning, and thorough examinations of events and institutions in New Orleans and our region. When you support our efforts, you join in on the process of examining life and culture in a way that makes us all better citizens and better people. Support the independent news that supports you and your life. Make a tax-free donation today at thelensnola.org, and thank you.
All right, well, let's move on to a sad story, another big loss for our community. Grammy Award-winning drummer Carrie Fatman Hunter was killed Mardi Gras morning. He was hit by a car as he was crossing, I think, Claiborne. Tell us about him.
Well, Fat Man was somebody who you just saw all the time. I mean, he loved his neighborhood. He was out there like that, like just walking to the store. He'd stop like through Kermit's nearly every day. And so he was around when he was home. He was around. You saw him. And so he also just was gigging at every good gig in town. Like he was at the Preservation Hall. He was, if there was something important going on, they hired Carrie Fatman Hunter. And often they hired him with Taniel Hingle. And those two had a long time snare drum, bass drum rhythm. Right. And that's a kind of a rarity in the world to understand like how much a bass drum and a snare drum can be almost like one creature that sets the same kind of rhythm together. Those two had played together. So if Fatman was 53, he probably played 45, 47 years with Taniel Hingle on the bass drum. And they just had a certain distinct sound together that we'll never hear again now, except for on recordings, you know?
Tell us about, for those who don't live in New Orleans, tell us what's unique about when one of our treasured musicians in our community dies, what happens and how moving that is.
Well, so they're actually, what happens first is, as soon as a musician passes, musicians get together and play. And then that happens usually every night until he goes into the grave. Other musicians go somewhere and play for him. And so for this, I think it was 10 days for Fat Man, 10 days running of just parades every night. And not parades, they look to the eye like parades, but they were processions in his honor, mm-hmm. that would go from the Treme to the place that he grew up, from Treme to the place where he was killed. He was hit by a drunk driver early Mardi Gras morning. And so there are certain destinations that the processions would take every night. And it's heart-wrenching, really. Like you see people working out their grief as they're moving along. I don't know. It's the thing about Fat Man, I think, that was also really difficult is that he was somebody who just, I mean, he made sure everybody else was doing the right thing all the time. So sometimes, you know, if somebody's kind of not doing what they're supposed to be doing and they're, you know, maybe destroying their health or doing something where you can understand that maybe their things are more precarious for them, it seems like it's
it's not that it's not hard still, but with Fat Man, I think everybody was like, man, you never, ever could have told me that we, that when I said goodbye to Fat Man on Monday night, that I was seeing him for the last time.
Mm.
Never. You never would have guessed it. It just didn't enter your mind.
From what I do know and what I understand of the culture of this city and of New Orleans, we lost a mogul, honestly. We lost someone who connected this city and kept it together and was really a part of the foundation and the roots of music. So I know that it's a heavy loss, and it was a tough one for a lot of people in this community.
It was also, and LaChance and I had a conversation about, you know, death just feels really close right now. And in this particular community, it's very fragile. Last year, we lost Jeffrey Hills, the tuba player who we talked about. We've lost Ravel Andrews, another tuba player who we talked about. We lost Sam Jackson, who was another snare drummer, whose whole family is in music and in Mardi Gras Indians. Black Mexican Indians. Sam was from the Young Fellas Brass Band. The bass drummer from the Young Fellas, Troy Edward, also passed away last year. We lost an entire back row of jazz musicians and within a year. And it's just one after the other. It's for different circumstances, but tragic each time. Their hearts are real heavy right now. It's just, you can't endure this many losses in that small community, you know? In the story, there's a picture of him with my son, Hector, who Hector's on the drums. He was about 2, I think. And Fat Man had no children of his own, but he mentored so many people. I have to say, I was talking to some people, and a bass drummer, Burnell Edwards, was saying to me, yeah, he was like everybody's uncle. He was like everybody's elder. And Burnell's elderly aunt, Margot, said, oh, yeah, he was my elder, too, even though I'm older than him. I just had that kind of respect for him, right?
Oh, that's beautiful. And
it was sweet, right?
Yeah, that's nice.
It's funny because a snare drummer said, oh, listen, I got to show you this. And he said, listen to this. He was in Sudan. He was like, New Birth was our band for the Sudan Social Aid and Pleasure Club. And listen to this. And he's like, you can hear the tap, 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 tap. And he's saying, okay, that is Fat Man. And listen with Taniel. Fat Man, Taniel. That's them. Right. It's just completely like he has like not the greatest phone in the world, and he's holding it up to my ear and having me listen to what they sound like. It's amazing.
That's so cool.
They're distinct like that. Yeah.
I don't know. I guess we'll just say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Okay.
Yeah. Good night.
This is Behind the Lens, a podcast from The Lens, New Orleans' first nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest newsroom. I'm Carolyn Heldman. Thanks to our guest this week, Deputy Editor and Education Reporter Marta Jusen. Special guest, Dr. Ashanta Wyatt, former principal of Edgar P. Harney Spirit of Excellence Academy, photojournalist LaChance Perry, and Lens editor, Katie Rechtel. You can read all the week's other news plus opinions at our website, thelensnola.org. Thanks for listening.